Hello out there, my friends. It is I, Hondo Onaka. Now you know what to do. You must tune in to my favorite podcast, The Five-ish Fangirls. Otherwise, there could be consequences.
The Tedges as we continue all the way to episode 455 of the Five-ish Fangirls podcast. A ancient Egyptian priest with godlike powers able to bring down plagues and destruction upon all who come into his path. What could possibly stop him from destroying the entire world? Maybe a kitten? Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of the Five-ish Fangirls podcast. So glad you joined us. Let's start off like a direct from the virtual table and see who's joined us this week.
This is Brittany in Belvedere.
This is Chrissy in Salt Lake City.
And this is Rachel in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, everyone.
Hey, everybody. Hello. We're back.
Yay. Nobody got transformed into anything during the eclipse.
Nope. You know, for the few moments I could see it, because it was very cloudy that day. But then clouds cleared it just long enough for everyone to run out and go take a look.
Yeah. But we got very, very lucky with the weather, because it looked like it was going to be cloudy, and it ended up being clear skies and like 70 degrees, so it was perfect to be sitting outside. So we went to a friend's house that lives out in BFE, Indiana, so we didn't have to worry about like light pollution or, you know, anything. And we had a cookout, and we sat around and, you know, just chatted and caught up and, you know, ate and drank and occasionally would look up in the sky with our eclipse glasses just to see what was going on. And then eventually it started happening, and then we got full totality, which I've never experienced before. And it was just, it was wild. It was so wild. Just as it was creeping up, it would almost like, you'd almost see the shift as it got darker, almost like someone just like adjusted the dimmer switch on a light or something, just a couple notches, and it got really quiet. And yeah, so once we reached 100% totality, it was really cool to be able to look at it with your naked eye. Nice. And to see all the stuff that happens, like all the pops of light and all the stuff that comes off of the sun because of the gravitational pull. Oh, so wild. It was so cool. So
nice.
Yeah. So hopefully those that were in the path to at least experience some of it had fun. And you can start planning for 2045, mm-hmm. where the ideal place apparently will be Walt Disney World.
They have about 20 years to increase prices so that
yeah, that won't be a problem for them.
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
But yeah, cool.
Yeah, so it was very cool. So especially coming off of my vacation, where on the way to North Carolina, Chauncey and I stopped in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, which is home of the Mothman. So we've very much been in this otherworldly, strange phenomenon type kind of mood recently. So why not talk about mummies in the process? So, but we shall get to that. First up, just a little bit of news, even for us being gone a couple of weeks, including one that I forgot to add. Thank you, Shalane, for pointing it out in your feedback that we will get to shortly, is we did get our first look at, it's not Beetlejuice 2, it's Beetlejuice. is the official title. So with Jenna Ortega and of course Winona Ryder and Catherine O'Hara. But yeah, and our and of course, yeah, our the man himself, as he as Michael Keaton says in the trailer, the juice is loose.
Yep.
So
yeah,
that should be a I'm excited, and as we get closer to when that releases, I may or may not, depending on the schedule, be doing an episode of Drunk Cinema with Charles and Zan for the OG Beetlejuice in prep for the sequel. So
there you go. So yeah, because we did our review.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back and watch that or listen to that, I should say. And then look for Rachel on Drunk Cinema.
Because I still have to wait till next year to see the stage musical when it comes through town. It is coming, but not until next year. So. And then we got an announcement slash confirmation, depending on you know where you get your information from. But we at least. For some of Shutagawa's second season of as the Doctor, the current Doctor, he is going to have two companions because Ruby Sunday will be continuing on. And then Virata Sethu will be joining. And I don't think they've given us a name for her character yet. Which, you know. Companions come and go for a while there. The at least publications, I'm going to use that term very loosely, like the Mirror, who can be trusted about as far as you can throw them, were saying that our current companion had been fired. And essentially just gotten a boot out the door. Obviously that is not the case. How long she will continue into Shuri's second season is obviously to be determined. But it's always fun and interesting when the Doctor has multiple companions.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially when a new companion comes along. After the first companion's already been around a while, because then the first companion knows like the 411. So, they'll be like, what's going on here? Well, let me explain it to you. You got a moment? Sit down. So there is that. And then in your podcast feeds, since it has been a hot minute, we've got two new episodes of Gold Standard in the feeds for you, including episode 99, which is our review of this year's Best Picture winner, Oppenheimer, which that was a really exciting discussion. And yes, I did get emotional when talking about Robert Downey Jr. that feeling is not going to go away anytime soon, I think. And then I can't believe one that we've caught up with the Academy Awards, and two, we have reached triple digits now with our 100th episode with the aforementioned Charles Skaggs bringing his first Bring Your Own Film to the Gold Standard Theater with the 1939 adaptation of Sherlock Holmes and the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Ooh.
Which was the first of what would become 14 Sherlock Holmes films starring Basil Rathbone.
oh boy. Well, I mean, that he went so far back. Now I feel a little silly with what I picked, although it was my second. Because somebody had already claimed my first, but
yeah. Oh, but, I mean, that's the whole fun of bring your own is you can. I mean, we have not done anything that old since we were in that decade.
That's true.
So it's been a long time since we've, you know, been able to go to old school Hollywood. So, yeah, I'm not complaining. Also, considering our next film is also in black and white and silent. So, which is, it's my pick, my first individual pick. So, because all three of us agreed on all the President's Men, so that was one all three of us brought. So
there you go.
But you shall have to wait for episode 101 to honor the beans for that. So, and then book club update. Because unfortunately Holly is not here. She had a little family emergency that is keeping her. It happens. Thankfully, everyone seems to be okay. So, you know, thank goodness. She's just stuck waiting, as they make you do at these things.
Yes. Whenever it's a medical emergency, there's a lot of hurry up and wait.
Yes, exactly. She did the hurry up part, now the wait part. But I do know that the book for this month is Doctor Who, The Shadows of Avalon. So I was able to glean that much from Goodreads. Mm-hmm. So, but as far as any polling, we're going to have to wait till Holly comes back.
Yeah, we will get that information ASAP. Yep. Probably, obviously. But cool.
Yep.
So,
that's a dot. And then next up, feedback. And I'm actually going to do this feedback in the order it was received. So we're going to do Aaron first. So Aaron, his subject line was, buy the damn thing, buy the damn thing. Hello, wonderful five-ish hosts. All right, knowing that you'll be discussing last night Oscars, I will give my own quick thoughts. Personally, I'm thrilled with all Oppenheimer's wins. I really love the movie. I was shocked that it lost adapted screenplay, considering the movie's almost entirely dialogue-driven. However, American Fiction was a great movie, and I'm happy to see it get something. Emma Stone I love as an actor, and I'm so happy to see her continued success. However, I hated Poor Things so much. I was hoping Sandra Hüller would pull off an upset, but I would have been happy with anyone other than Stone winning. Does that sound bad? No. My biggest cheer of the night was Godzilla Minus One winning visual effects. It's the first Godzilla movie from Toho to get any nomination, and I'm thrilled to see it win. Yeah, apparently Nick has gone on a Godzilla kick, watching as many of the modern-ish Godzillas as possible.
Everything I've heard about Godzilla Minus One, it is excellent. I was happy to see it win. Even though I haven't seen it yet, but I would really like to.
Yeah. But apparently it's good just as a story. Like Zan says, with her non-spoilery review is, she tends to watch things like the Godzilla movies just for the action bits. You know, Godzilla coming through town, destroying everything. But with this, the story is just as compelling as the action bits.
Yes, so. That is nearly universally. That is what everyone has said. Is like even just as a human story, it's excellent. Oh, and Godzilla's here too.
Mm-hmm.
So yes,
it's just an added bonus. It's like, oh yeah, giant monster, woohoo! As for Echo, she tells you how long. This has been in our inbox. I really enjoyed the series. I've been less enthusiastic about Marvel TV shows of late, but this one was fantastic. I enjoyed every aspect of it, and I look forward to seeing more of Alacqua Cox and Maya Lopez. My favorite part, though, Graham Greene, who makes every moment count and provides my favorite moment of blessing the item with the chant, buy the damn thing, buy the damn thing. Yes, that is quite funny, though. So. Graham Greene is can be quite the character when he wants to be. Take care, Aaron. All right, and from Shalane. Didn't we have the trailer for Beetlejuice 2 this past week? Yes, thank you, Shalane, for reminding me.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. I was a Hannah Montana Miley Cyrus fan, and my friends still love her. And we were both excited for her to be the first and only so far former Disney Channel star to be honored as a Disney legend. Maybe sometime in the future, we'll have former Disney Channel stars be honored as Disney legends.
Can I interrupt here for a second? Because this is my prerogative. When Shalane says she was a Hannah Montana fan back in the day, you're not kidding. Because she watched all of the show. I think we probably own some of the DVDs and mm-hmm. all the music and all the posters and all the things. It was her favorite. Ever. And Miley Cyrus.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I'm not saying. I just want everybody to know. Because she's underselling it. He was a Miley Cyrus fan when Hannah Montana was a big thing. Yes. Yes. All of the above times it by 10. And I'm not picking on her, and I'm not trying to be mean. Because I think it's fine. It's cool. It's fine. I'm sure a tear was shed with this with her becoming a Disney legend sort of thing. That's all. That is all. Proceed.
Fair, because I mean, there's lots of other of her era that mm-hmm. you know have gone on to be quite successful. I'm sure it's only a matter of time, probably before. Selena Gomez. My guess would hers. She would probably be next.
Yeah,
of that era.
Hillary yeah. Duff. That was another one that was pretty big. Lizzie McGuire. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that was quite the generation of Disney Channel stuff. Yep. But anyway, that was it.
Let's just say Shalane definitely earns her fan card and belong, you know, is definitely a card carrying member of the Five-ish fam. So.
Yep, that is true.
I also thought Mark Henn was already honored as a Disney legend. Maybe not as a Disney legend. He may have gotten, because Disney does do the handprints. In cement at the studio in California. So if you've seen the studio, which, I mean, the studio now, back in the day, they were a little more nondescript, but now people most probably recognize, like, the main building, which is the huge building with the seven dwarfs carved in the front of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Looking like they're holding up the roof, kind of.
It is endearing.
Yeah. Disney throughout time has done kind of like the Grauman's theater mm-hmm. with the handprint thing. So that might be what she's thinking about. So, which actually the Disney Legends also includes that now, but before. Before the Legends mm-hmm. title was a thing. So Disney's had various ways to honor people who have done a lot for the Disney brand. So this is the second Shakespeare adaptation after Romeo and Juliet. What's next? Probably The Lion King. Maybe. It might be having an anniversary this year too.
Yeah.
I mean, wink, nudge. I know people are like, yes, Lion King is totally a retelling of Hamlet. Yes, but also not exactly, but sort of if you tilt your head and squint.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I'm not going to I'm not going to quibble.
Yeah.
Except it did. So.
Just like 10 things is not an exact retelling of.
But, well, 10 things is more explicitly meant to be because you have, the Padua High School, Kat and Bianca, mm-hmm. Patrick Verona. There are
a lot of Easter eggs.
Mine King, not so much.
Yeah.
But it's still amazing. I'm not taking it away.
There's still a prince who talks to the ghost of his dead father, so.
Yeah. Yes, that is
true. And there's an evil uncle, so.
There's an evil uncle who kills the dad, but there's never, like, a real exploration of, the prince and the dad and the king. Like, do they really have a good relationship? Like, Mufasa and Simba do. Debatable.
Yep.
But anyway, Hamlet's great, Lion King's great, even their own ways. Anyway.
Yep.
That was it.
We'll continue that exploration when we get to it.
Yes, we will.
Anyway, I wasn't sure if I did like The Taming of the Shrew. After doing a paper about it for my class, I decided to like it and watch the movie with Elizabeth Taylor. I believe it's one of Shakespeare's best comedy works, and the festival that my college town is doing it this year. So is mine, actually. We have a place that does a Shakespeare festival in the fall. And they are doing Taming of the Shrew this year. So that must be the hot one this year. I'm planning to go to it, just saving money. Plus, if there's a Muppets version of Taming of the Shrew, it's perfect for Kermit and Miss Piggy. Yeah.
I
want that.
Now I want the Muppets just doing Shakespeare. We've had a Christmas Carol. We've had Treasure Island. They're not really doing a whole lot with the Muppets lately. That would be a good kind of revival sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Miss Piggy pretty much acts like Cat anyway.
Poor Kermit.
So. Yes. Yeah,
Everyone
write to Henson and
I'm kind of surprised this wasn't a thing already. Like
Petruchio, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I have to think on that one.
Yep. But anyway, don't have to say much about 10 Things I Hate About You. It has two actors from films done by Christopher Nolan, Heath Ledger and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I only know Heath Ledger from The Dark Knight and Ice Tale and 10 Things I Hate About You. When I saw Heath as the Joker, he's so different as the Joker and sounds so different, but I call that acting. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. That's why he won an Oscar for it. Everyone said the Joker is his best performance. Guess I get some, probably. It's definitely, I'm sure playing the Joker is not easy. It's not an easy character. It definitely stretches the person, I think, as an actor. Even the campy, like for me, Cesar Romero is my first Joker, the 60s television show. But even that, it's not easy to do camp without looking like you're phoning it in. So for Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the movies I've seen him in are The Dark Knight Rises, Angels in the Outfield, which is one of my earliest memories of seeing a movie in a movie theater, Angels in the Outfield, Treasure Planet, Inception, The Walk, Pinocchio, and 10 Things I Hate About You. I think my favorite films that Joseph are in is Angels in the Outfield and Treasure Planet. Anyway, I did love 10 Things I Hate About You. It's quite the rom-com of the early 2000s. Yes, it is. She says, going back to Heath Ledger, my favorite performance of him is in A Knight's Tale.
Same. The Joker's awesome. Great too.
Yeah. One of those is a bit more rewatchable than the other, I think.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
So that's kind of got it going for us. Yeah. Well, anyway, we are sticking with the late 90s, early 2000s.
Speaking of one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. Which, I knew that this had, the universe was pretty large. I did not realize how many damn spinoffs there were. of that damn Scorpion King movie.
Well, okay, there are only a handful of things I pay attention to. The first movie, the second movie, the animated series, and that's about it. Because yes, there was a
five Scorpion King movies.
I know. I have not seen a one.
And I didn't even know that there was an animated TV show.
I remember the animated TV show.
I gave up after The Mummy Returns, you know.
I stumbled on because I was still in my Saturday morning cartoon. Well, I mean, yeah, Saturday morning cartoons were still a thing, and it was on, I want to say Kids WB, but it could also have been Fox Kids. I cannot remember.
It was probably one of the Warner Brothers, because the movie was like the first movie to be shown on TV on the WB channel once it became a thing.
Okay. So. That sounds right. Okay. Yeah. But it was a good time. We'll say that. It was fun for what it was supposed to be. But anyway, yes, The Mummy.
The Mummy.
From 1999, starring Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz, Odette Fehr, and Arnold Vosloo as the titular mummy. And, can I gush for a minute? I just want to gush. Because, okay, so here's this thing. Like, in the late 90s, I had this, I mean, I was like, you know, preteen, like early teens. And I was kind of like getting used to the fact, like, oh, I can go see grown-up movies now. I was a very weird teenager. Let's just say that. Well, some of the movies I saw, like, gave me nightmares. And my parents rented The Mummy. And they told my younger sister, not Shalane, the one just younger than me, said, do not let her watch this. She will have nightmares. I watched it and I loved it. Part of the reason why is because I had a huge crush on Brendan Fraser back in the day, and I'd only really seen him in comedies. But I love those comedies, but it was so cool to see him in, like, an action hero sort of thing. And I thought it was so cool. And, like, dude, you need to do more of these. These are so fun. And also, Rachel Weisz as Evie, as Evelyn. Oh my gosh, like, you talk about your well-written, well-rounded female characters. I mean, now that I'm like older and I've seen it more and I kind of understand more about film critique and writing and characterization and all these things, I'm like, they hit it perfectly with this character. Is like, she is likable. She has those quirks, but without them being her entire personality. She's intelligent. She has skills. She's also flawed. She's also a bit naive. And she's got her problems that she has to overcome. But she's a very relatable person that just...
She's a little clumsy.
A little clumsy. And goes on this grand adventure. And I gotta say, the best thing about The Mummy is you've got Rick and Evie. So Rick is the swashbuckling, he's the Indiana Jones type. He's gonna shoot the bad guy, and you know,
and that was very much an inspiration for this was Indiana Jones.
Absolutely. Where, you know, he's going to save the damsel, save the world. But then you have so he's good at what he does. He does not pretend to be anything that he's not. On the opposite end, there is Evie, who is a scholar. She is a librarian. I'll get to that because I got to gush about that a bit too. And she knows about, you know, Egyptology. She knows the history. She dreams about dead guys. And but, you know, she's not a swashbuckler. She's not gonna. I mean, the one time she tries to pick up a gun and shoot somebody, at least in the first movie. She ends up ass over tea kettle trying to defend herself, and it's a little silly. And she can't hold her liquor, obviously. But it's like these two, they are like the perfect battle couple, I guess is what you want to say. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the perfect couple in an action story.
They're really just a good.
They're a good
couple.
They are equals in different ways. They are complementary equals, and I'm like, please give me more of couples like these. I want to see, you know, what you know. One does this very well, but maybe not as good as this other thing. But your opposite number is very good at that thing, but they might not be good at the other thing. And they work together. And yes, they fight. They have that argument in the middle when they come back to the fort after, you know, after Imhotep has been released, and Evie is like, I need to stop him because I started this. And Rick is like, no, we're leaving because my job was to get you there, take you back. I've done that. And I, you know, we're not staying. Of course, then Imhotep comes into the fort anyway. And it's like, well, what the hell? What do we do? And so they're like, okay, well, guess what? We better fix this problem. Mm-hmm. And so they do. And then you have Jonathan, who's just a dork. But he is comic relief, but he's not completely useless. The useless comic relief was the warden, and he died early on anyway, because he hate bugs. So, you know, it's
just, why are there so many bugs in these movies?
Arabs, and honestly, yes, this is the late 90s. Some of the effects are a little janky. Some of them still.
I will tell you, between the first and the second one, I think the second one, the first one has held up a little better, just yes, because. CGI Dwayne the Rock Johnson is a giant scorpion man.
No.
Oh my God, it's terrible.
That looked dated. That looked terrible when I was sitting in the movie theater watching that movie.
Yeah.
So it's not. That's not. That is not a fault of age. That is just a fault of. Oh gosh, it's like. So someone said it's like this looks like PS2 graphics. I was like, was the PlayStation 2 out then? I don't remember. But yes, the Scorpion King. We'll get to that. But yes, I just love this movie, and it's not. I mean, because you know, when you first hear The Mummy, you think of the old black and white Universal monsters, and they're updating it so it's going to be a horror movie. Well, you know, horror movies in the more modern era are. I don't do that. I'm sorry. I'm not a horror fan, especially the bloody, gory. Slasher type stuff, so that's, and maybe that's what my parents were expecting when they told my sister, don't let me watch this, otherwise, you know, I'm gonna have nightmares. But it's not, I mean, it's got enough horror elements to be scary enough, but not so scary that's the entire plot. Like in horror movies, your protagonists are helpless and they are going to lose. Like in horror movies, your protagonist loses, and they make them as unlikable as possible, so you don't feel bad when they you know are murdered horribly. In an action, sort of an action adventure fantasy like this, your protagonist has to win. The hero has to win. They have to fight the bad guy, defeat the evil, save the world. This is quintessential. I mean, you know, we love Indiana Jones for it's sort of that. 1930s, 1940s pulp adventure sort of style. This is the same thing. And you know, they talk about, excuse me, the behind the scenes when they were developing this is that they wanted to do a mummy movie, but they were like, well, do we do horror? Do we do this? Do we do that? And then they finally fell on doing, you know, it's like, it's an Indiana Jones type archaeological story.
It's Indiana Jones meets Jason and the Argonauts is the description that kept coming up when Summers came onto it when he was trying to pitch it. So, a kind of Indiana Jones or Jason and the Argonauts with the mummy as the creature giving the hero a hard time.
Pretty much, yeah.
So. Yeah, because this does I mean, the idea of mummies in general, obviously, the fascination with them dates back a long, long time. I actually mentioned this in our Hound of the Baskervilles, because there's a one guy in the movie that accuses another character of being a grave robber. And that is set in the late 1800s, so it's not quite turned into the, you know, the 1900s yet. But I was like, you're accusing this guy of being a grave robber, yet you come from a society, and this is the time period where, sorry, English folks, but, you know, if you're guilty, the English specifically decided that mummy unwrapping parties were going to be the cool thing to do. Like, these Egyptian tombs would be discovered, and then they'd bring them back to, like, London, and they'd put them in, like, the parlor of someone's house, and then they'd invite a bunch of friends over and be like, we're gonna unwrap this mummy, how would you like some tea?
Yeah, there was some weird, I mean, I have no problem with them, like, okay, we're gonna find these things, bring them to a museum, preserve them, so, mm-hmm. you know, the public can come and learn about this ancient civilization. And what, you know, what their customs were, the things they did, and, you know, maybe learn something about yourself in the process. The whole mummy unwrapping thing, and, like, people would do this thing, like, they would grind up mummy dust and put it in a drink and drink it because it was supposed to have health benefits. That was a thing.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they were used as fuel.
Yeah, that too. So I'm just kind of like,
Like burning a log on a fireplace. Sometimes they would burn up mummies.
Kind of like, come on, guys.
For like trains, steam ships.
I'm, you know, speaking of indie, I'm firmly in the camp of it belongs in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, every society has their weird, dumb things that are.
Yeah, I still love you, Britain. You have some respect for the dead.
Well, you know, the British Museum is pretty.
Yeah,
they're an institution, so bless them for that.
But as far as mummies in popular culture, especially cinema, dates back to the early days of Hollywood with the Universal monsters. With the very first film in 1932 with Boris Karloff as the mummy. Mm-hmm. And then they would go on between 1932 and 1955, make 6 films, with Tom Tyler being the mummy in the second film, The Mummy's Hand. And then Lon Chaney Jr. would take the role in the subsequent 3 films, The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's Ghost, and The Mummy's Curse. They were really stretching with these titles. and then Eddie Parker would finish off with the last film, Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, which is part of the Universal Classic Monsters universe. It is canon as far as Universal is concerned. And then there weren't any feature films, at least American feature films, until this one, but it took a long time to get there because it was the 80s, so like a good 25-ish years have passed at this point, you know.
This is one of those ideas. It was very much in production hell.
They just couldn't agree
on what they wanted to do with it.
Yeah. And Universal gave a couple producers the go-ahead to do an updated version of the 1932 film, but only if they kept it to about $10 million, which even in 1980s money is not a lot.
No. That's a pretty cheap movie.
Yeah, they wanted a low-budget horror franchise is what they wanted.
There is a place for such things.
That is, and you know, considering it was the 80s, you did have some people that you could tap on the shoulder and be like, hey, horror, you're a person to talk to. So in 1987, George A. Romero, King of the Zombies, among other things, wrote a film treatment and was attached to direct. Universal wanted a mummy akin to the Terminator, this like unstoppable, mindless creature.
Well, they definitely got the unstoppable part.
Yeah. And then Romero eventually walked away. That script was abandoned. And next, Clive Barker, who is another legend in horror, was tapped to direct after Hellraiser ended up being quite successful. His screenplay was very dark, very violent. While it would have been a great low budget movie, it was just too much for the studio. They considered it too perverted.
Yeah, that one
to be the movie that they wanted. So then Alan Ormsby was brought in, who was an interesting screenwriter, among other things. He wrote things like Porky's 2. So figure that out. But he pitched a more straightforward update to the 1932 film, focusing on the mommy as a relentless Terminator-like character. Had Joe Dante was attached as director. The budget was increased because he wanted Daniel Day-Lewis to play the mummy.
knowing how Daniel Day-Lewis, how much of a method actor he is.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see that just to see what he would do to get in character.
Yeah.
The mummy.
A little bit.
That would be kind of funny. I mean, no offense to Daniel Day-Lewis. He is like one of the best actors in, you know, who've ever acted in cinema. But there are some amusing stories. That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah, so. But Universal didn't like the higher price tag. So then in 1994, Romero comes back with a version that's more zombie-like, akin to Night of the Living Dead. Again, he's king of the zombies. And he completed a draft in 1994. And it revolved around a female archaeologist and her discovery of the tomb of Imhotep. And it was going to be set in America in modern times. The mummy ends up being awakened after being exposed to the rays of an MRI machine. So.
Okay.
Yeah. And his script was considered too dark and violent. So.
I think the problem that they were running into is they kept bringing in horror directors, which is, you know, it's not a bad thing.
But, right, but there's horror, but then there's style, horror.
Yeah, the style and approach to horror had changed dramatically between 1932 and the present day when they were trying to do this, because. Yeah. The black and white one, yes, it was scary. Yes, it's horror for that time. But I think these days we would classify it more as thriller, which is very different.
Yeah.
And the mummy movie we got, it has elements of a thriller in it. It's not a full on thriller, but it definitely borrows from that. From the genre. So yeah. I think
it's like you bring in people who are like, you know, again, George A. Romero, King of the Zombies, which, you know, the original Night of the Living Dead
Right.
I mean, it's scary, but it's still, especially compared to what we're exposed to now,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of, mm-hmm. It's not weak, but it's just not like, you know, like making you probably have nightmares now.
Right.
Probably then, but not now. And then you get Clint Barker, who is a horror writer and has created characters like Hellraiser and Candyman. So it's like, yeah, there's horror and then there's horror.
Yeah.
So,
I actually did see Candyman at a, I was 8 years old. I was at a friend's birthday party. Well, I wouldn't say she was a close friend. She was like someone in my neighborhood and just invited me to sleep over. And her like older sister came and said, "Hey kids, let's watch Candyman." And in my naive, stupid mind is like, "Is that like Willy Wonka?" No. that one. My mom was mad. I had nightmares. I didn't sleep for at least a week. So this is what we're talking about.
I saw 28 Days Later, like my early 20s, and that was just like, so so again, Romero out. and then we had another previous attempt return, this time combining the elements of the 32 film and the 1942 film. It's gonna be a period piece in Egyptian, awash in Egyptian art inspired art deco, but again, too expensive.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. So, and then Universal got sold. So then Scheinberg, one of the producers, was going to produce it through his independent company and write a new script, but he couldn't find a high profile writer and director. Wes Craven was offered. He turned it down. Again, horror. And so Garris left again. So then Universal hired Kevin Jarre in 1996 to write a new screenplay. At this point, the executives were convinced that the film should be a larger budget period piece. Took them long enough. So Stephen Sommers was called. And like I said, his vision was a kind of Indiana Jones or Jason and the Argonauts with the mummy as a creature giving the hero a hard time. He had seen the original film when he was 8 and wanted to recreate the things he liked about it, but on a larger scale. He wanted to make a mummy film, but other writers or directors were always attached and they'd leave. So then late 90s Universal finds themselves in the need for a hit film because for some reason Babe Pig in the City did not do well. They decided, let's look at successful franchises from the 30s. The new chair of the studio, Stacy Snyder, distributed packets detailing the studio's holdings, which included nearly 5,000 old scripts and films. Sommers realized this was his opportunity and pitched his mummy to Universal with an 18-page treatment, and they bit. He did his own research into, ancient Egypt and the like, and also hired an archaeological professor from UCLA to make sure that the language was as accurate as possible. And they liked his treatment. They liked that it took place in the 20s rather than a contemporary setting. So they approved it, increased the budget, and he spent a year working on the screenplay and eventually was able to cast the movie we got in 1999, which apparently several actors were considered and or approached for Rick. including Tom Cruise, who would go on to make the horrible Dark Universe film in 2017, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, and Ben Affleck, who were either not interested or could not fit it into their schedule. Leonardo DiCaprio was approached, actually wanted to do it, but was already committed to another film. Tried to get the other film to be put on pause so that he could do this. They told him no. And then the film that he was originally dedicated to ended up being postponed anyway, but by then it was too late. So
no, I mean, I hear all those names, and yes, they were all big names back in the day. I mean, DiCaprio came off Titanic, holy cow. I can't see any of them being as good. I'm sorry. I mean, obviously, Tom Cruise, bless him, he just that other Mummy movie was just like, nah, no.
Yeah, we're not even talking about that one.
that one does not exist.
Anyway. Yeah. So eventually it went to, obviously, Brendan Fraser, who thought that Fraser fit the Errol Flynn swashbuckling character he had envisioned for Rick perfectly because of Brendan's performance in George of the Jungle.
Yep. Okay, so here's the funny thing. I mean, listening to, like, all of this saga of, like, all the different ideas people had, and they, like, wanted to set it in modern day and make it, you know, that kind of a thing, which, you know, I guess that could be fun. At the same time, it would not have the charm that it has if it, you know, the time period is just so important to, to how they do this. And yeah, you like I said, it's that pulp adventure feel that it has to it, and you know, and Brendan Fraser, you know, he definitely has that charm. He's got the good looks, but you know, he was a very, you know, and as we found out later, that was sort of to his detriment, or a lot to his detriment, a very physical actor, even in, you know, his comedy and all that stuff. But it really worked in this one, which makes me really sad that he had so many injuries to, you know, just through his whole acting career with all the stunts and things he did. But at the same time, it really made the movie work, or, you know, just that much better. So I am torn. I hate saying this because I know how negatively it affected him later, but I'm like, but it looks so good. I'm sorry. But, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah. Rachel Weisz, much easier, although she did have to audition several times before getting the part, but she was kind of the top choice from the start. She herself is not a fan of horror films, but saw this more as almost a comic book type movie. So she didn't have as much of a problem with it. John Hannah, who's cast as her brother, didn't think he was funny. But that's why he was cast in the, the first place. So,
So John Hannah didn't think that he as an actor was very funny, or that the character
Hannah felt he was not a comedic actor, and Summers, our director, said that he has no idea why we cast him.
He was like, that's just silly. He's like the funniest one. And also, I mean, it's not.
I think because he does the kind of.
It's the dry, like, kind of devil may care. Like Jonathan, okay. I mean, you hear
him. He thinks he's smart, but not as smart as he thinks he is.
Yes.
And that gets him into trouble really easily. Mm-hmm. Hence, watch his arc in as Holden Radcliffe in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
yeah. Well, I mean, like, you hear our families, or maybe your family has one, or maybe you are the one where there's one.
If you don't think your family has one, you are it.
You are it. Mm-hmm. There's always one sibling who's just kind of a screw up, and who doesn't, like, you know, just runs after all these odd schemes and different things, and like, he's very smart, and he's intelligent, maybe not the same way his sister is, he's a little more street smart, but apparently not enough. So it comes off as kind of a goofball, very silly, but then he has his heroic moments, which, like, he's not a hero like Rick is, but, you know, he reads the golden book and takes control of the mummy guards that are trying to, you know, they're fighting Rick, and turn him on the mummy of Aksunamun, who's trying to kill his sister. So it's like, yes, he gets some heroic moments. He gets his day in the sun. He's also just kind of a goofball at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's just the cast is, I mean, I was trying to think about this in D&D terms. Because it's very much this could very much be a D&D campaign. Because
I think I actually seen a meme about that.
Yeah,
the mummy.
So like Jonathan is a rogue with not a very high stealth skill. And you know, Rick is obviously,
as someone who regularly plays a rogue, I find that very, very dishonorable to the label.
Well, I was trying to think, because he's not very magical. He's not very charismatic. He tries to steal things, but he's not very good about it. He's not very good at it. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out. But obviously, Evie is the wizard, because they study a lot. And Rick is the fighter. And then you have... I forget his name. The actor's Oded Fehr, but he's the paladin. But yes, the Medjay.
Yeah.
Totally blanking on his name, which really sucks because I had a crush on him too. But I mean, because, you know, he shows up later. So, like, somebody, so you think about it.
Ardeth Bay,
thank you. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like, you know, so, like, they started this campaign, and, you know, someone had the warden as their, well, he's another rogue who's kind of not that competent. It's like, man, these guys have really bad luck with rogues. Sorry, Rachel, but they do. Well, then he gets killed by the scarab, so the player writes up another character, and that's the paladin, who's supposed to be protecting the city and keeping people from summoning the mummy, and now they failed. Well, now they gotta kill the thing. So that's his character. That's your character. And then, you know, the various NPCs and cannon fodder that come up along the way. But yes, this is very much, this could very much be run as a D&D campaign. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you've got your dungeon, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your creature that you unwittingly brought back to life. And then
You got your various artifacts.
You get your loot.
You got some spells.
By the end, they, like, accidentally walk off with a bunch of treasure from the city, because you have Benny, who actually is a very good kind of, he's kind of a skeez ball, but he's a very good rogue. But then he ends up working for the mummy anyway. So it's like,
because apparently this particular mummy understands Hebrew.
Yes. Oh man. No, we had a D&D campaign a while ago. Well, this is several years ago, where one of the players actually did draw up a character, and his name was Benny. And he actually did have talismans from all different deities that would, you know, brandish them in times of trouble and see which one worked. So, you see, I mean, this movie is inspired. Just on so many levels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's what's so good about it. It's just, you know, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the fact that it's steeped in a lot of actual mythology.
Yes. And that makes
it much more believable.
Yes. Because you can watch this and maybe you're not learning as such, but you kind of, you know, it goes back to that, hey, you know, we dig up these ancient Egyptian artifacts, learn about their culture, take them to a museum and study them, let other people see them, and it just kind of, you know, gets your imagination going of, you know, what all these things would be like. So it's very cool and a lot of fun. And then I don't know, like I could gush on the 99 movie Mummy a lot.
Yeah.
Someone else wants it, it, does anybody else want to?
I mean, it's just it sets up you know, it's funny because, like, when this was released, you know, it was released May 7th, 1999. And, like, either the same day or the next day, our intrepid director, Steven Sommers, gets a phone call from Universal saying, we want another one.
Yep.
So...
You know, as well as this one did, a sequel was inevitable. That's just how things work.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that, you know, like, it was, all things considering, you know, this was in development hell for literally decades.
Yep.
Or some version of it was in development hell.
The idea was in development hell, yes.
Yeah. The fact that they were able to film this in 17 weeks. Which, in my mind, that seems kind of fast for such a big film as this.
Yeah.
They filmed in Morocco, because I feel this could be said in any time period, it would be accurate. The political conditions in Egypt were too unstable.
Yeah.
seems like that still would be appropriate now and way before.
25 years on, what's changed?
Yeah, nothing. But it helped because actually Marrakesh in Morocco has not been as modernized as Cairo, so it made it easier to fake it was 1920s. And they also filmed in the Sahara Desert itself. They filmed near a volcano that had given up the ghost, essentially. you know, they made sure that the medical team on hand made sure that everyone was hydrated because of the heat in the Sahara, so they were able to come up with a beverage for them to drink, probably full of electrolytes and stuff like that, that they would drink every 2 hours. Sandstorms occurred on a daily basis. Wildlife was a problem. Several crew members had to be airlifted to medical care after being bitten or stung. Because scorpions, snakes, our thing, especially in the desert. Brendan almost died when they were filming the hanging scene because he did start to get hung.
Yeah. I'm just like, dude, I know you're kind of into this method acting thing and you really, you know, want to make it look good, but for the love of hell, no.
Yeah.
No, you do not have to do this.
John Hannah broke his wrist at one point.
That's why they had the scene of him getting him bit by the by the scarab, so they could have a reason for him to be wearing like a bandage or a brace.
They actually had official support of the Royal Moroccan Army And, you know, we've talked about insuring, you know, actors, because, you know, that was part of the reason why Robert Downey Jr. was, you know, nobody wanted to touch him because he wasn't insurable. In this case, the cast did not know this until after it was over, but part of their insurance included a kidnapping clause.
Oh, fun.
They had to have kidnapping insurance taken out on them.
Sorry, then.
Because of the area. Yeah. They may have been Morocco, but Egypt, not that far away. Yeah, and they're still in the Middle East.
That was a clean issue back then.
Yeah. But the fact that they, you know, they got it done and then, you know, went into post-production. They had $20 million in the budget for special effects. They only used 15, so I'm sure that helped.
Oh, I'm sure.
A lot of the special effects were done by ILM, of course. Because, mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about, you know, big epic films with lots of, you know, with special effects, you're going to use the people who did Star Wars. And while there is some digital special effects and CGI in here, they also tried to do some things practically, or as practical as you can. So instead of Imhotep being full CGI, they did... motion capture.
Mm-hmm.
So then they could put like the digital, depending on at what point of decay Imhotep is in, mm-hmm. they could put patches all over the actor, and then they could digitally remove that. So he was able to actually act,
yes,
face to face.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it's not so much, you know, like the armies and stuff. Those are all CGI, and, you know, Brendan Fraser had to figure out how to choreograph him fighting, you know, these soldiers while they're not actually there.
Yeah, and there is some, like, you can, as you're watching that battle at the end, you can kind of tell it's like, okay, yeah, there's definitely some choreography going here, but
yeah,
they make it look good enough.
Yeah,
for sure. But yeah, like, I mean, keep in mind, this is just a couple years before the first Lord of the Rings came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these things are very new technologies, but, mm-hmm.
but the technology is like,
but it's getting there, but yeah,
it's advancing very, very quickly.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
This is advancing very fast. And there are some, this is, I mean, like, now I'm like looking at all these dates of when these movies came out, I'm like, man, this was like a golden age of,
mm-hmm.
This is the sweet spot. This is where they got it. They got it figured out
with, mm-hmm.
like, all the digital. Other than the unfortunate Scorpion King, which we'll get to. But
mm-hmm.
but you know, it's just yeah. you know.
And then you got your yeah. You got your score composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith. The Mount Rushmore of film composers.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be up there with John Williams and some others. We'd have to have more than four, I think. But
The music in this is mwah.
Mm-hmm.
So good. That
yep.
really.
Yep. Yep. So, like I said, this was, you know, it was released, and almost immediately, Universal's calling, going, "We want another one." So they find themselves going, okay, well, let's do another one. And the thing is like, you know, the cast was totally down for it. And Stephen Sommers was like, well, you know, if we're going to do this, I want to be able to tell a story that's, you know, not... like what you'd expect from a sequel. He's like, I want to do something different and even more exciting and more, you know, action adventure. And he's like, I want to use He specifically says, when talking about making the sequel, he wants to utilize the latest and greatest technology, movie making techniques, so that this looks even better than the first one. And all I can think about is that damn Scorpion King and how awful it looks.
And that is very unfortunate, because, like I said, when I was very excited to see the sequel, because I had watched The Mummy quite a few times. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I love these characters. I love this story. What are they going to do next? Very excited for it. And yes, Mummy Returns is great. I mean, you know, it's like 10 years later, Rick and Evie are married. They have a son named Alex. And no, I did not name my son after the Alex in this movie. It's just a coincidence. They are very well off, and their adventures in the first movie have, Evie is kind of a bigwig with the Bembridge scholars. They finally accepted her as a thing. Oh, and that was the other thing I was going to say. You know, I love that they didn't go with, oh, she's a woman, so she can't be a scholar. They went, no, you don't have enough experience. And that could be true of anyone. Well, now she's got some MF and experience, you know. She's almost been killed by legions of the undead. Found the fabled city of Hamunaptra. Jeez. Yeah, now, no, she is the darling of the scholars. And they come back from a dig, and their son unlocks the evil bracelet of great wickedness that's going to kill him if they don't get to the pyramid in time.
You get the phone call right after he sees the map. 7 days. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like Mummy Returns. I really do. It's a lot of fun. It's a good time. The characters are all good. There's just, I don't know, there are just some little things that I'm like, it's just doesn't quite reach the heights of the first movie.
I mean, if you want to get picky, the title is kind of misleading, because Imhotep doesn't have a lot of screen time in this one.
No, he really doesn't. It's more like, I mean, they kind of allude to this whole, oh, you know, in a previous life, Evie, you were, you know, this Egyptian
Nefertiti.
Well, they specifically didn't call her Nefertiti because they knew, like, all the 15-year-old boys would be giggling about tits. Yes. So she's Nefertiri. Whatever.
But we all know what they mean, like, though.
But at the same time, it's like, this is a franchise that had a woman in it where she was wearing nothing but gold paint and maybe some pasties. So I'm like, I think that's the least of your problems, if that even is a problem. But like, Rick is supposed to be part of this too, but he's not in the flashbacks or anything like that, which I kind of was like waiting for when they brought that up. Also, Evie, like I said in the first one, like, she's not a gunfighter, and you know, okay, yes, they're married. They've been married for a decade, and he is going to teach her some certain ways of, you know, some things about defending yourself and stuff like that. She gets a little too Rambo, and not like, and when I say that, I don't mean like, yeah, she's going out and kicking ass and taking names, but it's like, okay, I wasn't expecting that level of, you know, you pick up a gun and start blasting mummies sort of a thing. She's competent and she's good at it. It just was sort of jarring to go from the cute, mousy librarian who is still very intelligent and capable, but, you know, rubbish with weapons. And then all of a sudden she's just like, oh, yes, I got this. Mm-hmm. And maybe again, there's that time skip, which I don't know. It was just very jarring is what I'm saying between the two films.
Yeah.
So maybe they got her, but then, you know, but then there's moments where she's still the Evie we know and love, because, you know, she's like giving them all these little tidbits as they're floating on that hot air balloon, and all, you know, and just she can't help herself from being a walking Egyptian encyclopedia, and we love her. So my quibbles are not huge, and they do not break the movie for me, but they are there.
And again,
you know, tug at your heartstrings.
Bugs.
Bugs. Yeah, there's always bugs.
I mean, they can have the Rock eating a scorpion.
Okay, bugs. Okay, here's my thing. I don't get too squeamish around bugs for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I hate Black Widow spiders. I was actually bitten by one once. Not fun. I hate scorpions. Now, I do not live in a place where scorpions are plentiful. I'm going to keep it that way.
Yeah.
Scorpions, just the look of them just creeps me the F out. I'm like, nope, 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 nope. Like, you ever see that comic strip of Godzilla going back out into the ocean, flipping the bird with both fingers, going, nope, nope, nope? That's mm-hmm. me, scorpions. Just, do not want. Why you would put a stinger on a crab, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But
nature, like, unless you're a honey badger, no thank you.
Right? Yes. So, yeah. Anyway. But yeah, I hate scorpions. I hate that bit of the rock with the scorpion. I'm just like,
yeah.
It just, bleh, give me the willies.
Like, surely there's an easier way to sell your soul to the god of the dead.
Come on, man. But yeah, I mean, there's some good ideas here. Very good ideas. Just, again, this is kind of what happens with sequels, is they get all these really cool ideas and they want to just put them all in. And like, you have the Scorpion King at the beginning. You don't see him again until the very end, sadly. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
But, I mean, you cast the Rock, and it's like, you know, if you're going to do something like this, he's the kind of person you cast.
Well, I mean, back then, he was just getting into movies and acting.
Yeah.
I think this was the first movie.
Is this the first, his first? I know it's the first one I am aware of.
I think so. It may be
his first. But yeah, there's a lot going on, and I wish they could have taken some of these ideas and done, like, just like put them in other movies. But
yeah, it's his first film, so he'd done some TV,
uh-huh.
not wrestling, although essentially playing a wrestler. He was in an episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah,
a couple of music videos, but yeah, The Mummy Returns was his first feature film.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he would go on to do the Scorpion King spinoff, but not in any of the other Scorpion King movies. Those were Matthias, adult, grown up Matthias. Obviously, when you're anything involving young Matthias, couldn't be The Rock anyway, but. Mm-hmm. When you're talking adult Matthias, they just got a guy that's roughly the same build and put a beard on him and hope that nobody would notice a difference, I think. Even though Matthias is played like by like two or three different guys across the four other films. Mm-hmm. So. So yeah, I have not seen any of the Scorpion King movies, and I have not seen the third one either, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor.
Yeah,
so.
I've seen parts of Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. I think it was like on like HBO or something, and I caught the end of it, and I'm like,
yeah,
okay, I
which
know
these again, are- you know, and you look at the cast, and you're like, oh, this has to be pretty good. You got Jet Li as mm-hmm. the Dragon Emperor, you know, awesome. You know, martial arts film star. Rachel Weisz does not come back as Evelyn. She's replaced by Maria Bello. John Hannah comes back. You've got Michelle Yeoh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, badass. And it's an interesting story as how this ties in kind of to everything else, but this tells a story of the Chinese clay soldier statues, if you've ever seen those. I've seen them in person a few times. It's really cool to see, like, somebody took a lot of time to make all these clay soldiers that are just like duplicates, and there's thousands of them. It's wild. So it's if you know, if you're still wanting some like mythology that's kind of set in real life, it's an interesting aspect, you know, it moves time forward. So now that their son, Alex, is closer to being an adult, this is set in 46. So it's, you know, towards the end of World War II. And
World War II is over by 46.
Essentially, but I mean, there's still outliers.
Oh, that's true.
Because, like, Rick and Evelyn are Evie are supposed to be doing, like, one last mission for the Brits or something, and that's why Alex is off doing his own thing.
Yeah, yeah, the like I said, I haven't seen the full movie, nor do I really want to.
Yeah.
But it's just, like, it just seems like the dynamics are off, and not just because, you know, it's not Rachel Weisz playing Evie anymore, although that does play into it, but it just kind of feels like everybody but Brendan Fraser is phoning it in. They're like, yeah, I'm here to collect a paycheck. Essentially. And it's like, why do you call it the Mummy when the Mummy isn't actually in it? Like, I know that's the franchise. I know that's the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, they had the animated series, which kind of took them all over the place. But I think, I'm trying to remember, I think Imhotep was still kind of being a pain in the butt for them.
I want to.
Yeah, I think so. Again, it's been many years. But it's just kind of like, it's like, yeah, this would have been a fun idea if you hadn't called it the Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just, I mean, I don't know how you differentiate it. Because, yeah, if you want these characters to come back and do something different, you still want to make sure, like, it's still, that people still know it's the Mummy.
I think maybe they're using just, like, the idea of a mummy as a very loose definition for any person who's been entombed in some form or fashion.
Because
technically Imhotep was not mummified. His soldiers were, but he was technically not mummified. He was stuck in kind of
a Ouroboros cycle
with the scarabs.
Yeah, they always called him the creature. But
right.
You know, but it's just, I don't know. I mean, I guess
so. Like the Chinese soldiers were entombed in these, you know, this clay. Right. So, you know, I guess if you use the term mummy as just anything that's been kind of encased in something, then technically it works. But
yeah, I think maybe that was a problem with marketing, because I know it's like the Mummy : Tomb of the Dragon Emperor. Yeah. So it's more like, oh, like, you know, with Star Wars, you have Star Wars, A New Hope, Star Wars, you know, Return of, or Empire Strikes Back, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the marketing kind of made it seem like the Mummy should be in this and it's not. I don't know, but it's just kind of off. It's just not, I don't know. Which is a shame, but at the same time, it's like, as we've learned, milking franchises just it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
In general.
Hence their attempt at creating a universe with Tom Cruise.
How about you get one of these that's a hit that's working, and before you are like, now we're gonna do like 10 of these, and before you even know how the first one is gonna do, that should have been
just because Marvel took a big gamble doesn't mean everybody needs to start too.
and doesn't mean that it's gonna work for everybody.
Yeah,
that's the other thing.
Thankfully, outside of this, they have not touched the theme park ride. So, Revenge of the Mummy, which is at several of the Universal Studios theme parks, which opened it depends on which one you're talking about. The one in Florida started running in 2004. Same thing with Hollywood, and then Singapore opened in 2010. But it's just based on the first two movies, and really only the first one. Because if I remember correctly, the Scorpion King doesn't really come into play as far as the actual attraction. But it's kind of meta in a way. Because they're like, when you're waiting in line, you're seeing like, you're supposed to be going through this museum of antiquities, and there's like props from the film, or you're supposed to be the film setup of a fictional sequel titled Revenge of the Mummy. And there's props and concept art. There's behind the scenes on how the first movie was made, and how the film itself was supposedly cursed. And then Brendan Fraser appears in some video, and he refuses to wear this Magi symbol that's supposed to protect him from the curse. You go, and when you get on the and somehow there's an accident, and you time travel into the 1940s, and it's an archaeological dig at Egyptian tomb. So essentially you're experiencing this plot of this fictional sequel that never actually, it is a sequel, but it's not. And there's scarabs that come out, you know, that are not real. They're a projection, but it's creepy enough. And you end up going against Imhotep, and there's fog and drops and all these things, and all this stuff. And then when you finally get to the end, and Brendan Fraser is like, "Hey, welcome back." You know?
I love that they got him to do that. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's a fun attraction. It's really popular. I mean, the last time I went there, I mean, I don't know how long we stood in line. It was a while. It was quite a while. But I think part of that was also that the attraction kept breaking down. So, because it's a very in like
complex
attraction. Like, if you've ever been on like the Indiana Jones ride that's at a Disneyland, it's a very similar idea as far as like the combination of practical effects, projections, you know, sound, wind, smoke, fire, you know, oversized props, that sort of thing. So it's very technologically advanced. And because it's so popular, they haven't touched it, you know, other than, I'm sure, cleaning it up and, you know, as projectors get more advanced, replacing the projectors so the projections look nicer.
Basic
maintenance and upgrades. But other than that, it's a fantastic attraction. It's funny. I have a friend he's had it medically taken care of now, but he had a kidney stone.
Oh wow.
And he had nothing he was doing like at home as far as like liquids and stuff was helping, so he ended up going to Universal and riding the Mummy 3 times in a row hoping that it would help. It didn't. He ended up having to go to having it surgically taken care of, but okay, it was just like, he's like, "I rode the Mummy 3 times in a row and I still got this damn kidney stone."
I would have laughed if that's what did it. That would have been so cool. Yeah. But,
well, then people were telling him, "No, you need to go to Disney and ride the Big Thunder Mountain. That's been proven to help." He's like, "I tried that too."
That is awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's one of my sort of bucket list things that I'm like, I want to go and ride this ride at Universal, but we will see if I ever make it.
Same.
Yeah. And sometimes if you get lucky, you can catch outside they'll have like people dressed up in like Egyptian garb and walking around on like stilts and stuff, helping with the theme. So It's cool. It's one of my favorites. So I'm glad that Universal is kept it. Although, you know, it's Universal and a mummy of some sorts is, one of their pillars. So,
yeah, I know they're putting an Epic Universe and they're supposed to be like a Universal Monsters section, which that should be good. So hopefully they don't get rid of the ride, or if like they move it over there, however, like just keep it. However you keep it.
Yeah, because the Universal Monsters actually don't get a lot of recognition.
Which is a shame.
In the parks.
I wish they could do more with that. I mean, I know they tried, but it was like, don't do the shared universe thing.
Yeah.
I wish what they would do is look at the 99 Mummy. And just kind of be like, do that with these other things. Because there are some really good, there's some good material and good ideas they could do. Because obviously they did it. And yes, we know it took forever for them to figure it out. But it's like, okay, you got it. Now do that with like Dracula and the Wolfman and the whatever else there is. Those are the two I remember the most.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That Creature from the Black Lagoon. I remember Boris Karloff, okay?
Yeah.
Classic. that kind of thing, but it's like, oh. But yes, the 99 Mummy, that's like, that is like, one, like, you know, you'll ask people like, well, what are your five movies that if you're on a desert island that you must have? And I'm like, and I have not narrowed it down. First off, I got to count Lord of the Rings as one. That's got to be just one. But Mummy is definitely on the list. And there's probably some others, but I'm like, those two, I'm like, that's what I want. I need those. And it just, and I loved after, because I've loved the Mummy since I saw it when I was 14, or however old, 14, 15. When I first saw it, I've loved it. And I never really knew that other people were really into it. And then the Tom Cruise Mummy came out, and you hear everybody, like, no joke, everybody saying, like, if it's not the Brendan Fraser one, I don't want it. And I'm like, I'm not the only one who loves this movie. That makes me so happy. There are other people who love this. I hadn't really heard much. I just know I liked that movie, and when I got... You know, and I made sure I bought a copy so I would have it for myself, and I would watch it, you know, like, I wouldn't, like, maybe not necessarily every Halloween, but I would watch it as much as I could, and when I remember and whatever. But it's just like, oh, other people love it too. This is so
I mean, even now, like, you see it, it's become like a meme. Yeah, you'll see like bumper stickers or T-shirts or stuff, and it's like, I'd rather be at home watching the 1999 film, The Mummy, with Brendan Fraser. You know,
I have seen those, and I'm like, I need one of those.
Yeah,
where'd you get that? I need it. I need one.
Yeah,
and it just kind of reinforces it, you know, that love for those pulp adventure stories, that it's just a well-written, well-structured adventure, and it's just there to entertain and to be fun, and you know, just it makes me happy, and I need to go watch it again. And I will watch The Mummy Returns too, and I'll we'll touch briefly on the animated series. It was like if Indiana Jones was a weekly cartoon, which I know there was a young Indiana Jones in live action, but I don't know much about it, never watched it, but it was, you know, just sort of a globe trotting, hey, we're gonna go find this artifact, and it kind of expanded on the plot of The Mummy Returns, where Alex has the bracelet, but it's not like, oh my gosh, kid, you're gonna die in 7 days, but it sort of like guided them to the next step of their adventure, and the next step was always some artifact they had to find in some far-flung locale in the world. And, you know, they had resources, they had a plane, they had, you know, people that they knew along the way. And I mean, obviously the voice actors were not the actors from the movie, but they did a good job. They were they kept the characters. They were recognizable as, you know, Rick and Evie and Jonathan and Ardeth Bay had been showed up. I can't remember. He was there all the time, or like I said, it's been a hot minute, but I mean, I feel like I'm like that's what I need to have on like DVD.
I didn't even know there was a cartoon, so
yeah, I have no idea if it's ever been released, like had a home release or anything like that. But it was, you know, again, Saturday morning cartoon. I don't want to say it was like anything groundbreaking, but again, it was a good time. It's like the movie itself, and it kind of gave you that same vibe, I guess. But I mean, I would probably, if I were to watch it again, I would, like, it would just be pure out of pure nostalgia and just to be like, huh, I remember. And it was probably like super campy.
Imhotep was voiced by Jim Cummings.
Of course he was. Oh my gosh. Bless Jim Cummings forever.
Let's see. October 2002, Universal released The Mummy, Quest of the Lost Scrolls on VHS and DVD. Was a mashup of the first episode of the series and the last two episodes from season one. And then Universal Studios Home Entertainment released the entire series on DVD in region one in three volume sets in 2008.
Okay, I'm going to see if I can track those down. If they're still available.
Good luck.
Yes, I know.
I believe at least the first film is available in 4K now. So...
Alrighty. So, okay, take a look for that.
If you've got the ability for super, 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 super high def. High def beyond your wildest dreams.
Not sure.
You're good, but
you want that mummy coming in bright and clear.
Yeah.
You know, scare the pants off you.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Imhotep is gonna crawl up your nose.
No, thank you. I mean, would that feel like having a red hot
better than having a
stuck up your nose
scarab running around under my skin? Blech.
Throw things about a bit and rip it all out through your nostrils. Ooh, that would hurt. Well, it's called mummification. You'd be dead when they do this.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of, I need to tell you this awesome story. So when I was starting my grad program to get my Master of Library Science, you know, you always, when you start these courses or these, you know, your major or whatever, there's always the introduction class that you have your first semester. But I'm taking this class, and I've got the syllabus, and the professor puts on there, here's a list of movies with librarians in them. Watch these movies and write a paragraph or two about how these librarians use, reference librarian skills in the story. And Mummy and Mummy Returns was on the list.
Nice.
And I'm like, I actually own those movies. I'm going to watch one and I'm going to write about it. So I actually wrote, I had an assignment to watch The Mummy and write a little, it wasn't a full paper, but a little short essay about it. And I just, I'm like.
Like, and this is why Evie is awesome.
This is why Evie is awesome. And every librarian everywhere has that gif or image or whatever. They just have it somewhere in their lives of I'm a librarian. Because we're awesome. And it wasn't, I was not inspired to go to become a librarian because of Evie, but it didn't hurt.
Yeah.
I'm like.
Like, it didn't dissuade you.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I can do cool things and, you know, read books that are going to probably end the world. Sign me up. No.
Like, we have all seen Well, yeah. We've all seen at least some sort of movie to know that if you're handed a book called Something of the Dead or of the Damned or something like that, and you just happen to be able to read whatever ancient language it's written in, read it to yourself in your head.
Yeah.
Not out loud.
No. Although that's the other thing I love. That's another part I love about one of my favorite. I mean, the whole scene's great, where you know Evie's like she's got the book and she's opening the key and she's like this isn't the Book of Amun-Ra, this is the Book of the Dead. And Rick goes, the Book of the Dead? You sure you want to be playing around with that thing? And I'm like,
and then he's like, what does it say? And she's like, blah 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 blah. And immediately they're like, no, you're not supposed to read from it.
It's just awesome that Rick is like, he's like saying everything that the audience is saying right then. It's like, no, 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 don't do that.
Yeah.
He's like, I told you not to play around with that thing. Didn't I tell you to play not to play around with that thing?
Yeah, you also ask, what does it say? So
that is true. He did ask what it says. So he does shoulder some of the responsibility here. Because he didn't necessarily stop her.
Yeah.
But she did it anyway.
I've seen The Evil Dead.
Yep.
Yeah. Even if you can't read it and there's a recording, don't play the recording either. If you start hearing a language that you don't understand, stop it. Ancient languages and old books, just it doesn't end well for anybody.
No, especially when the book is like made of gold or it's all
made out of human skin.
Has human skin or stuff like that. It's like, no, 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 no. Just,
yeah.
Just, I mean, at, you know, at very least, just leave it alone. If you can, you know, burn it in some way, somehow, some way, do that.
Mm-hmm. But just leave it alone. No touchy.
Then again, the movie wouldn't be able to happen, so.
Well, yeah, that's true. So it was just like, strange books, if they're closed, they're closed for
yes.
Even the book in Hocus Pocus. Like, it's in English, but still. Just keep it closed. Don't open it.
For those of you, here's kind of a deep cut. If you've ever played the video game Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem. No, you absolutely should not pick up the Tome of Eternal Darkness. You really shouldn't. I mean, the game cannot proceed if you don't, but... Oh man.
A minor detail.
Minor detail. It's like, well, you know, as long as it's them and not me. I'm not reading the evil, dark, awful book of death of death, destruction, and doom.
Yeah.
No way. It's them. It's those idiots on the screen.
Yeah.
Mummy, the mummy is a treasure. The treasure of cinema. I don't know how the critics
and
feel
no
about it.
and no grave robbing required.
Nope. The Bembridge scholars, they all already got that taken care of and put it in a museum and studied it. There you go. All
right. Put these movies in a museum in hundreds of years from now.
It's like, what did you guys think mummies would do? And it's like, it's a movie. It's for fun. We're enjoying ourselves. But yeah. So if you haven't watched The Mummy in a while, or you know, want to go check out some of the other spinoffs, or if you've watched any of those spinoffs and just want to send in a quick little review of
tell us why you subject
tell us why, and maybe one of them's a hidden gem. I don't know. I kind of after that terrible CGI, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm not into the Scorpion King. I'm good. You're good. But anyway, send us some feedback. Send us a quick little review if you would be so kind, and tell me if I remembered the animated series right, because I'm not sure how much I remember it. But anyway. Just send us some feedback. Our email address is fiveishfangirls@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, which is thefiveishfangirls.com. There you will find links to all of our social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. And we will, you know, if you leave comments there, we will read those off as feedback as well. You can, you know, obviously our show notes and everything, all of the links to stuff we've talked about will be on the website. Oh, okay. Let me finish this and then I'll get back to the other thing. Sorry, squirrel. And also on the website, we have, you can find the podcast everywhere you find podcasts. We also have ways to support the podcast with money if you are able and willing to do so. We have a Patreon. We have a merch shop that really helps us out with, you know, hosting and server and all that. Mm-hmm. All those things, all those incidentals that we have to deal with to do a podcast. But as always, we thank you for your support, for your listening, your feedback, and just, you know, being our listeners and being our community, and we enjoy you. And just one little FYI, if you are not aware, on April 26th, there is a special one-night showing. I don't know if it's through Fathom Events or something else, but The Mummy will be playing in theaters for the 25th anniversary. So check out your local theater and see if one anywhere near you is playing it, because it would kind of be awesome for it to that one night showing to make a blip on the old box office numbers. Mm-hmm. And it's a Friday night, so I think there might be some afternoon ones as well, though we found one that was at 7:30. Unfortunately, our like big Megaplex chain isn't carrying it, but I think it's like Cinemark and AMC theaters. That's what seems to be who's doing it. So if you've got something like that near you, go see it, because it would be so cool to see it in the theaters. So if you have known about that, now you do. So go forth and read books about dead guys.
Yeah.
Or read books that will bring...
As long as they're not latched shut and written in something other than English.
Well, you know, if you know, like, Spanish or something.
Well, I meant ancient languages.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, nothing in Latin and nothing in ancient Egyptian.
Yeah. Maybe not even Hebrew, just in case. Sorry, Nick.
Hebrew's okay.
Yeah. Just have Nick on standby, just in case.
Yeah, you know what'll calm these golems down? Yeah. Asking for a friend.
Yep. All right. So with that PSA, we shall sign off for this week.
This is Brittany and Belvedere saying goodnight.
This is Chrissy saying goodnight from Salt Lake City.
And this is Rachel in Indianapolis, India. So what is the plural of Anubis? Is it Anubai? Anubises? Asking for a friend.
I actually have no idea.
5ish fam, for joining us on this week's geeky journey. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Stay connected with us on our website, the5ishfangirls.com, and follow us on most social media with @5ishfangirls. Plus, check out our nonprofit, Fangirls Give Back, to see how we're making a positive impact in our community. Until next time, stay nerdy and let the squee continue.